Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight, it is always a pleasure to see them, Kent Russell, CEO and curator at the Museum of Russian Icons. Kent, it's welcome back.
Thanks for
having
me.
You're looking really hale and hearty, by the way.
I'm feeling it.
You're good. And welcome back, Laura Garrity Arquette. She is a registrar and the curatorial assistant at the Museum of Russian Icons. And today we're talking about, this is a show I'm really looking forward to, you guys. It's an exhibition of the photography of Emil Otto Hoppe, Photographs of the Ballet Russe. Now, before we start talking about him, okay, let's talk about the Ballet Russe. Because that was, that for people who've never heard of the Ballet Russe, that was a major art happening. Ken, you want to talk about that?
Oh, it was the phenomenon of the early 20th century. There was nothing more radical, more groundbreaking than the Ballet Russe. And the Ballet Russe was about a total shift in aesthetics, in world art. It merged, and it was the first performance, really, if you look back to it.
Performance art.
Absolutely. Because Diaghilev, who was an entrepreneur, a cultural entrepreneur, ostensibly created ballets. But it was much more than that, because Matisse, Picasso, you name it, in the 20th century, designed costumes, sets,
And people have never seen the designs from the Ballet Russe, from people like Bakst and stuff like that. It's amazing stuff. We don't have anything that's comparable to that today, where there's sort of a joining of visual and performance arts.
And these, music.
And music. And this sort of spectacular, because pieces were commissioned for the Ballet Russe to perform.
Yeah, all the greats, Stravinsky onwards.
So how long were they, like what were the years we're
talking
about?
The big years were the turn of the century to the 20s.
Okay. Those so the Russian Revolution.
And then they became expatriates because the Bolsheviks weren't that happy with it.
Well, they were not that happy about a lot of things.
Well, they were very radical. And it was really also the first openly gay aesthetic movement the century. And Diaghilev, while he didn't flaunt necessarily, but a large number of the core were well-known homosexuals in the early 20th century and had a life that was both transcending the underworld of the gay culture at that time and the mainstream. So it was terribly exciting and fascinating.
It was an amazing time period, and it was amazing. First of all, it was the whole beginning of modernism. So they were definitely caught up in part of the modernist movement, modernist painting movement. And they were and they toured around. I mean, did they ever come to the United States?
I don't think they did. The Ballet Russe didn't. No. They eventually wound up in Monte Carlo as sort of the butt end.
That's sort of an interesting place
history.
To end up.
I know. It's sort of typical if you start to think of it, you know.
Now, the photographer we're talking about has a really strange life history. Again, we're talking about Emil Otto Hoppe, H-O-P-P-E, accent over the E. What an interesting guy. You want to talk about how did he start?
He's really fascinating. He was supposed to be a banker, which I think is the most fascinating thing. And he had taken a job in Asia, and then before traveling there and taking his job and settling down to a life of finances and banking and great wealth, he traveled to the UK to see an old school friend. And there fell in love and married his school friend's sister and stayed. He took a less prestigious job and became an amateur photographer, really as a hobby. Mm. And then over time, actually quite quickly, he became one of the most prolific, most well-known, not just portrait photography, although he made some amazing movements there, but also landscape photography, and he did street photography. And so he would take his, the quietest camera was a Brownie, and he would put it inside a paper bag with a slit, and he would walk the streets. And then as he started traveling the world, he did the same thing. So he captured moments, and his skill in capturing the essence of a moment and somehow managing to capture the personality of his subject, the beauty of the landscape, I think was never before, you know, had never really been done. Ansel Adams was one of his peers. He certainly, you know, was a match. But nobody was as famous in his day as a photographer as Hoppe.
What's interesting, though, and before we go into more about his career, is that I'd never heard the name before.
You're not alone.
Yeah.
And that's the great tragedy. And the simple answer is that his entire archive was sold to a commercial concern, and his entire...
the Mansell Collection.
Mansell Collection was cataloged as, you know, the corner of Fifth Avenue and...
So
and
they, were not in they were not even cataloged according to the photographer.
No,
they were just subject matter.
Just subject matter and used for journalistic purposes.
That's like stuff when you call it up on the web today and you see this whole list of pictures of like a band or something.
Exactly.
Like that. No,
images.
That's all it was.
That's all it was.
So how did you guys come across this show?
Well, Curatorial Assistants reached out to us. They had it was actually Graham Howe who acquired this collection, and he brought it out of obscurity. And the Curatorial Assistants had the arduous task from 1994 onwards of cataloging each photo, of gathering all the details, and of putting together these collections. And so they had the Ballet Russe collection, and it fits in with our mission. It's part of, you know, Russian culture, at least in a sense.
Absolutely.
You know, it's very separate from the icons, but I think it's very important for us to explore.
But that's one of the things we've talked about before, Kent, is that the museum's expanding its idea of what it's showing. It's obviously going to be always committed to the Russian icon.
Right.
But you are expanding it to almost a museum of Russian concepts, of Russian art
culture,
forms, culture.
And even Slavic culture.
Slavic culture, too.
Slavic culture. But having said all of that, that one of the set designers for Diaghilev was Goncharova.
Oh, yeah.
And she's,
Natalia Goncharova.
She's wonderful.
One of the great modernist, Russian modernist
right.
artists.
Right, and directly related to icons. One of the ballets had icons as set designs.
Yeah, if you've never seen her work, there is a direct relationship. And as a matter of fact, icons are, for Russian modernism, icons are a tremendous influence.
They are huge. They're the bedrock.
They really are. Now, according to your press material, it was the advocacy of the historian Bill Jay who tracked him down in a nursing home in England.
I know, in the 70s.
This is a sad story.
It is. Yeah, it is and it isn't, in a funny way.
Well, granted, after he's dead, he's now famous.
Yeah. I don't know his biography at the end of his life, whether he was bitter and twisted.
Oh, okay.
But he was certainly rediscovered by the then socialites. He photographed...
Cecil Beaton.
Cecil Beaton rediscovered
it. You did the correct pronunciation, by the way. I gave it the American pronunciation. Cecil Beaton, who was one of the leading photographers at the time and became an advocate for him.
Absolutely. He reestablished Hoppe's reputation and set aside his own.
Where does most of the collection reside now?
It's in California, as Laura said, in this new archive, the Emil Hoppe Archive.
Is there going to be an idea of like trying to organize other exhibitions? Because it's amazing to read who he photographed: King George V,
I know,
the British royal family, and then he did George Bernard Shaw, Marlena Dietrich, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Rudyard Kipling, Albert Einstein, Eugene O'Neill.
I know, everybody.
This guy should be like a household name.
He should be, and he will be. In the photography archives, he'll be back. The next generation.
So let's talk about him in the Ballet Russe. The Ballet Russe and Diaghilev, they were very particular about the images. So there's not a lot of photographers that have photographed the Ballet Russe.
No, there's not.
I mostly know him from artwork on posters and costume design and set design.
It was, I think, a calculated move to retain the grandeur, to retain the magic of the Ballet Russe, to keep photography to a minimum.
And we were talking about this before, and Diaghilev's idea behind that, and trying to, well, you know, and what you said, I think is Laura said, is probably correct. You know, pay your money to see what see we're doing.
Oh,
come
yes.
and see. But I can see that the visual sort of uniqueness of the Ballet Russe. You don't want to spoil that. You want the people to come in, sit down, and then you want the wow factor. to happen. And I can sort of understand that to a point.
Yeah,
exactly. They were doing something that had never been done before. And if it becomes widely publicized, especially if they bring in videographers, which they almost never did, others could start to really imitate it. And I think part of it was retaining that for the company.
Now, sometimes the images were used for commercial purposes, but that's only a very,
very
few.
Rarely. Very rarely. Yeah, Diaghilev really.
So when people uncovered these images, these were brand. People had never seen these images then before.
No, this will be a revelation.
When I looked at the images that you sent me in advance of this interview, I had never seen any of these.
Yeah. I mean, there's the famous one of Nijinsky on his knees. That's an emblematic Nijinsky image.
But most of these I have never seen before.
No.
Now, how many images are going to be in the show?
There's about 60.
Wow.
There's a lot. It's a big show.
So who hangs that show? You?
Laura hangs it. Yeah.
We have a great team. A small team, but a great team. So we all wear multiple hats. But I guarantee you that everyone will be in there with hammers and nails helping.
That's a lot of photography to hang.
Yeah.
It is. As we speak, my contractors are repairing all the holes in the wall from the last show I hang.
Museum people works fun.
Well, you know, people who don't understand how museums work have no concept. They come in and they see a show and they think it's like, well, cool. And they don't realize there's a whole set of things that have to be done and then have to be repaired from the last show.
Yeah.
Lighting is huge in a photography showdown, and that's going to be a real challenge with this.
It will be, actually.
Photography is hard to light. Yep. First off, everything is in glass frames. And so you have to...
You're looking for problems with reflection.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
An evenness.
And...
Wow.
But we have a great lighting system. So... But that's always
I
the trickiest
actually
bit.
Really love people learning about how museums work, by the way.
Yeah.
I really do. Because I think museums don't get enough credit for the actual work
that
they do.
Well, the thing is, the end result, you need to make it look easy.
You're right. So you should make it look so that the audience walks away like, no big deal.
No big deal.
I love that philosophy.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. So I want to talk to you about some of your favorite images. Do you have favorites, Kent? The Nijinsky one, you have to like.
Yeah, you have to love that because there's that sense of recognition. It's mostly what Laura said earlier, that sense of intimacy, that sense of encountering
the artists. Did he have free reign?
He had free reign. It was unique. He was behind the scenes, clicking away.
There was no other photographer that had that kind of access.
No, absolutely not.
And he was very clandestine about it. You know, he would set up, you know, a portrait studio and do formal portraits, but he would also just appear and start taking photographs. If his subjects were willing, he would click away. And again, it is hard to pick a favorite because they're all so amazing because you feel almost as if you're in that moment.
Wow.
Because he had a skill that few photographers have of capturing that exact instant that shows you the essence, the personality.
We talk about, you know, I always imagine what it'd be like to go back in time to experience certain things. The Ballet Russe is one of them.
Yeah.
You want to be there for one of the big opening
nights. I think
nights.
You really do, yeah. Really and do. One of the big scandalous opening nights.
That's right.
The Rites of Spring.
Rites of Spring.
Where people walked out and booed.
Yes. People don't understand that now. And if you've never listened to Rites of Spring, it was like people went. This was like when Dylan played electric guitar at the Newport Jazz Festival, except worse.
Yes, except worse. Yeah.
People, why was that kind of reaction? Like, it was jarring music for people's ears, I guess. It was
also very sexualized, the thing is. And, you know, that was shocking. That sort of took people by surprise.
I forgot entirely about that opening.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of opening you exactly want because no press is bad press and everybody was there the next night.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That was great. And if you out there, look up the opening of The Rites of Spring. If you only know it from Fantasia, you have no knowledge of that piece. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest today are Kent Russell. Always a pleasure to talk to him. CEO and curator at the Museum of Russian Icons. And Laura Garrity Arkit, registrar and curatorial assistant at the Museum of Russian Icons. And we're talking about this great exhibition, Emil Otto Hoppe, photographs of the Ballet Russe. This is one of those things. Most of these images have not been shown in the public before, and this is a great chance to come and see them. And are you going to have any special events that go along with this?
Oh, we have tons of special events, and it's also accompanied by a beautiful book. So that's really well worth for.
So there's a catalog.
It's a compendium of his photographs.
Oh, wow.
So it acts as a catalog.
So it has other photographs besides.
Yes, it does.
Does it have photographs of some of the famous people?
A few, and it's beautiful.
Oh,
it's
man.
A beautiful, beautiful publication.
So what events do we have?
Oh boy, we have tons of stuff. We have Russian Herbalism Lecture and Nature Walk on Saturday, October 5th.
Stop with that. November 5th or October 5th?
It's October 5th. Sorry.
That's
October
already happened. 5th.
It's already happened. We're past.
But you know, can I stop you about that?
Yeah, but that's a really good,
Can I stop you about that? What happened on that? Like, what was that like?
It was really...
I wish we had that person down.
I wasn't able to participate, but Amy Consalvi, our director of education,
has done a
really exciting series on Russian health. And so,
oh, wow.
It was really wonderful, this kind of insight into Russian spirituality beyond religion, but into kind of folk spirituality. So the different herbs that are used for healing, for not just medicinal uses, but also, you know, just health.
Do you think you'll do that again? Because that sounds like something I'd love to
talk
about.
Yeah, it's like a great program.
I think so. And then on November 2nd, we have Healthy Basics of Russian Cuisine.
Cooking class?
Cooking class. If you can imagine.
You guys are really trying a lot of different things.
We're trying to connect with our audience.
I think it's important. There's such a disconnect between American culture and Russian culture.
Oh, especially right now.
And what Amy is managing to do with this is to say, look, Americans are concerned about health, and this is how we do it. We know how we do it. And come and explore how the Russians are doing it and make this interesting connection. So connecting American culture to Russian culture, even without art. And I think it was an amazing group of people who came. They were all really happy, and I think
it sounds like a fascinating program.
Yeah.
So do you have to register in advance?
Yes.
For all of ours.
Actually, the health series, the first one sold out. So anybody interested in the cooking class
you have limited participation.
Yes.
Okay. So what else is coming up?
And then we have a lecture. It's a Russian alternative to French perfume, the history of soap making in Russia. So that's another part of that series. That's on.
So you're really you're covering every aspect of Russian culture.
Well, or think of it, the Ballet Russe after a ballet, you need soap.
Or a doctor.
So that's on November 10th.
That's amazing.
The 14th is when we officially open the Hopé exhibition.
How long is it open for?
It is open through
March 8th.
March 8th.
Okay.
Sorry. So it's a members only opening. So if you want to come to the opening, I highly suggest you call and sign up for a membership and come. It's going to be a wonderful party. We'll have themed appetizers and drinks, and staff will be on hand to answer questions. It'll be the time to kind of explore the photographs before anybody else gets to.
Infused vodka and sparkling wine.
I know what you're
after.
It'll
be very Russian.
You'll be rushing afterwards.
Yeah.
Ken, I want to talk to you about the museum, because every time they have you down, I want people to know about this, because this is a really unique museum within Worcester County, within the United States.
Mm.
We don't have a lot of museums that have an instantaneous international connection. Can you talk about how it started? Talk about the start of, because as Laura was saying, I mean, this is a time where there's a lot of tensions about Russia today. But there's a history of Russian culture that goes back a long, long way that has lots of traditions, both artistic and cultural.
Mm-hmm.
And how did this museum start?
Well, it was Gordon Langton, who was the president of NIPRO in Clinton, He opened up a small operation in Moscow, a manufacturing operation in Moscow, in the early 90s, and encountered icons for the first time. And between 1991, roughly, and 2006, when the museum opened some 13 years ago, he had collected close to 1,000 icons over that period. He was voracious. He had a great eye. He really knew what he was doing. And those were early days before the oligarchs started to collect icons and before they went into the multi-million dollar value stratosphere. So he was able to collect within a period of the 17th to the 19th century, a virtually encyclopedic collection in that slice of time. We have a number of early 15th century icons, but not a huge amount.
Right.
The glory of the collection is the 16th and 17th century specifically.
Now, as soon as you talk about a collection like that, and this is one of the fascinating things that the Museum of Russian Icons do, is you have a collection that people can look at from an artistic, cultural point of view, but it's a serious religious object for a lot of people too.
That is,
and it's I don't know of any other museum that has to sort of.
There are a few museums out there that have strong religious collections. I would say ours is especially unique in that these are to the Orthodox. They transcend artwork.
Right.
They are seen first as religious objects. And so I always say we walk the edge of a knife.
That's right.
Our kind of objectiveness in retaining a secular study of these, but respecting the faith.
Does that mean you have to provide space for people to have personal experiences with the objects?
You know, I think we would have done that anyway. Icons have a very powerful presence.
Yeah.
The way they're painted, the way they seem to glow, the way that the layers of paint are put down from dark to light, they have this glow about them. They are very powerful. And so we find people who aren't even Orthodox who tend to have an emotional reaction. And so from the very beginning, with Gordon's initial designs, the space was very... it was set up for quiet spaces, so we have lots of seating available. We play music through the sound system to mask any other sounds, so people can talk.
Wow.
People can feel like they're in a quiet space.
So just the experience of going to the Museum of Russian Icons is a unique experience. It's not like going to your regular art museum.
No, we would hope it would be, to an extent, contemplative. Because what you need to do is that the icons, because of their regard, the way they look at you so directly, they get your attention right away. That's a given, and that's the process. That's deliberate. That's why they are icons. So once they engage your attention, what we find is that, unlike traditional museums, people tend to spend more time at the Museum of Russian Icons.
Yep, that makes sense.
So it's interesting.
Regardless religious background. Yeah, they're not the kinds of objects you can just sort of breeze by.
No, they demand your attention.
And the symbolism and the iconography of
them. Very deep,
very complex.
Very
complicated. And that's the other role that the museum has to play, which is the interpretation of the objects.
Yep. Absolutely. And we, as Laura said, it's a bit of a knife edge because we are a secular institution. We are an art museum that has this nonpareil collection of sacred art. And at the same time, we have to respect the tradition and the fact that it is venerated believers.
I think it's one of the most unique museums I know.
It certainly is.
So for you as the director, is that just a nightmare?
Well, no, it's
I know you never say no.
It's another Higgins Armory Museum. It's another strange museum.
We go back to those days, man, Kent. I think it's a more unique idea because there's a lot more going on.
Yes, there is.
With these objects. But at the same point, like this show here about Emil Otto Hoppe's photography, you're expanding beyond that. Will you ever collect objects anymore?
Well, we do collect icons.
But you won't collect other Russian...
Well, we do. We have a collection of lacquer boxes, Matryoshka dolls.
I remember that show.
Context objects. It's a question whether the museum probably needs to remain focused on its treasures, the Russian icon. But for the average visitor, a context is important because if you delve into just the icons, you don't necessarily understand their impact, their broad impact, or how they fit into a broad Christian Orthodox Slavic culture, because they're pan-Slavic throughout the Slavic world, and the Armenians, for God's sake, have icons. So, you know, the icon is ubiquitous in Central Europe and throughout Russia. And that's something that's interesting. Why?
It's really fascinating. And you know, we've go back many years, Kent, and you've gone through a history of working with museums who are very unique. Yeah. You've never just gone to a regular art museum. No. You've always chosen these unique. And so you were sort of you found your perfect spot here at the Museum of
Russian. I certainly did. Yeah, yeah.
Did all that experience from the past help you?
Of course it did.
Because you had to remain flexible and you had to sort of think outside the box constantly for every museum you're associated
with. Because the problem with unique collections is that, it's a challenge. It's not a problem. You have a core audience who's always going to want to see Russian icons.
That's
so,
right.
I mean, Laura's my witness. We get people, you know, not a lot, but who will fly in from anywhere across the world.
Well, it is
See the collection.
It's a must-see destination.
It's a must-see. If you're interested in Russian icons, there are a handful. There's the Louvre Museum in Paris. There's the Recklinghausen Museum in Germany. And lo and behold, there's the Museum of Russian Icons in Clinton, Massachusetts. And that is it, buddy. Wow. That's it. And you've got to visit those three outside of Russia.
At some point, I'm just going to have you down, and I want to talk about being the director of museums. Because I think you're a wealth of information, and you've really done you've lived a life. My guests tonight have been Kent Russell, CEO and curator at the Museum of Russian Icons, and Laura Garrity Arquette, registrar, curatorial assistant at the Museum of Russian Icons. And this is a must-see show, both if you love photography, both if you love the history of modernism, and then if you're interested in Russian culture. The exhibition is Emile Otto Hoppe, Photographs of the Ballet Russe. Thank you both for coming down.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.